Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast about two grown men arguing over a children's film from 1982, which might be funny if it weren't sadly how the actual internet behaves most of the time. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Canningeezer.
So welcome back to Film Strips, the podcast in which we... Every episode has to connect back to the preceding one via who stars in a movie or directed it or...
A film strip itself. It's like we planned it.
Indeed. So last week, or last episode, I should say, we stopped in for a little bit of Scottish horror with The Wicker Man, which I would say, Andrew, we both enjoyed that film immensely.
Yeah, we had a very productive and interesting conversation about it. Of course, we had to bracket that off because I feel like we could do double the episode length just talking about the minutia. Do you know what happened on the audio levels on that one?
I'm honestly not sure. I know I've heard a little bit of a complaint. I shouldn't say complaint. Apparently, the early half of it... was a little bit off, but it improved by the midway point. I don't know whether it was something in Audacity when I was exporting it and doing the final mix, or if it was just something glitching with my mic at the time it happened, because I think for the most part, it was just my vocal levels on the early part of it.
Well, I think, David, this might be a great time to let our listeners know that if there are any issues with the show that you know, or any issues you have with what we're saying on it, feel free to shout out. We listen. We respond. And yes, we only occasionally blow out your eardrums.
Precisely. So we do apologize for that one, folks, but we will do better going forward. But yeah, I would say, Andrew, following that episode, you know, we've done a fair amount of horror lately and a fair amount of crime cinema, so it felt like it was time to shake it up. Would you agree?
Yeah, we had our second Halloween in the early summer.
Yeah, and I'm not opposed to that. I'm quite happy doing that, but...
I don't mind. Yeah. Horror is very seldom boring.
Yeah.
Even if it's bad, things are happening.
Well, and that's exactly... I mean, I don't know if you saw the news. I mean, Exorcist 2 is getting a special edition release from the Shout Factory.
Ooh.
I can't believe I
slept on that breaking headline.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, but horror, generally interesting. But yeah, I felt, you know, with it being my pick this week, that we would do something a little different. I figured, hey, we got Christopher Lee, and the obvious thing would be to select something, one of his Dracula movies, or...
Bleg.
Little fantasy epic known as The Lord of the Rings.
Thou shalt not pass.
Yes, well, I did choose a film from the makers of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings... The Return of the King, the television special from the late 1970s, and that is The Last Unicorn, starring Christopher Lee, Angela Lansbury, Jeff Bridges, Alan Arkin, and Mia Farrow.
A veritable who's who.
Yes, and if this is a film some of you may be familiar with, a good chunk of you, I imagine, probably are not. And, I'll throw this out to you, Andrew, first. How familiar were you with this particular title before it was thrown onto the podcast list for the show?
Well, I've probably encountered it in various forms as the title. I had never seen it, and I knew very little about it. Back when I was a different kind of career student, I actually did a lot of research on animation. So this was a title that will often come up reading essays and things like that, but I can't say I ever came across it until you brought it up.
Yes, and I'm sure you're very thankful for that. So... What is The Last Unicorn, you may be asking yourselves? And the short answer is, it is a 1982 fantasy animated film. Ostensibly, I would say a family movie, although I think this pushes the upper boundaries of what that might be in many regards.
I think that's actually what a lot of our conversation this episode is going to be about.
Yeah. But yes, it's based on a novel by Peter S. Beagle from 1968, which he also wrote the screenplay for this film adaptation. And I have not read this book. I know it is quite beloved, even receiving a comic book adaptation from IDW, illustrated by Renee DeLiz, within about the last decade.
But, I mean, comics have also adapted Sonic the Hedgehog meeting Alien versus Predator, so that's not always a stamp of quality.
I'm not saying it's a stamp of quality, I'm just saying that typically comics aren't known for going out of their way and finding, you know, pieces of, you know, I don't want to say obscure literature, but not exactly in the mainstream literature, or literature in general, for the most part, unless somebody somewhere is a diehard enough fan.
It at least has enough of a presence that they are adapting it.
Precisely. So it's not something that is without its fan base. And in the early 1980s, it ended up becoming a film from Rankin Bass. The individuals, Arthur Rankin and Jules Bass, who directed the film. And if you're familiar with their names, it's probably because you're familiar with the endless number of television specials that they have directed over the 60s, 70s, and 80s. From anything from, say, your beloved Christmas classics, to things such as the previously mentioned Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King adaptation, and The Hobbit television film adaptation, which, pound for pound, I would say is superior to Peter Jackson's film, if only because it's significantly shorter.
Which is interesting, because it's not even the most well-known Lord of the Rings animated adaptation of around the same period. Because, yeah, I remember as a teenager going to my grandpa's house, and he had satellite, and then all of a sudden they had Lord of the Rings on in the middle of the afternoon. I'm like, hey, isn't that coming out to theaters later in the year? Let me check it out. And then I'm like, oh, it's anime. But then I realized it wasn't the Ralph Bakshi one either. I remember it at least being a complete film series.
That is true. I mean, they did end up, I mean, basically it is a sequel, more or less, to the Bakshi film, completing the story that he didn't get to finish in his Lord of the Rings adaptation. So, ostensibly they're of a piece, but not really when you watch them close together.
Okay, so kissing cousins.
Sort of, yeah. But yeah, I think anybody who grew up, you know, having to read The Hobbit in high school is probably familiar with their animated adaptation, at least from our generation, when that was the only thing they would really go to. That or the BBC radio adaptation. But I digress. But what's interesting about this film also is not just that it's an adaptation of a work by individuals who were, you know, mostly known for TV animation. It's the fact that when they did this, this film comes out in 1982, and this is right in the midst of the period before the Disney Renaissance of the late 80s happens.
Mm-hmm.
So this is basically at the time when, if you want to talk about Disney having a weak or a low point when anybody could have ostensibly come up and, you know, kicked him to the curb and said, here, we're dominating the family film market right now. This was the time to do it. And a fair
now,
number
David,
of different...
if I may,
yeah,
let me pretend that I'm a CBC interviewer for a moment. And let me ask you, what is Disney?
Fair points. So, for the three of you out there who may not know what Disney is and somehow got a hold of this podcast, hello. I don't know how this happened. But putting that aside, Disney, the company, started by one Walt Disney, basically got their start in animation, became...
And pretty much stayed there.
It did. There were times that they broke through away from that early on, doing things such as 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, their first real live-action film, then branching off into doing some television work. They had their Zorro series, I think that was in the late 1950s, amongst other things. But they were pretty much, you know, very quickly became the sort of dominant brand in American animation, in a way that other countries hadn't experienced. But it was pretty much, they were the gold standard. Then Walt died, and that period of time after his death, which is pretty much in the early, throughout the 70s and up to the mid to late 80s, is kind of viewed as sort of Disney's dark period, where the company sort of lost focus and direction, and they became known for cranking out a fair number of fairly disposable, if beloved, films.
Well, it's like Apple after Steve Jobs, you know, where when your brand is so closely linked to a certain individual and, you know, in running the studio, they actually do play that role. When they're gone, I mean, it's not necessarily game over, but you need to figure out what you're doing now.
Well, and this is the thing. I mean, Disney during this period, the one thing is, I admit, this is an era that had a fair number of commercial flops and was not necessarily the most critically beloved period in Disney's history. But it is the period in which, if you want to talk about Disney experimenting and doing some weird, weird stuff, this is the period of time I would highly recommend everybody start looking at. Because, again, this is the era that gave us things like Disney deciding, we're going to do The Black Hole, a film which, you know, pretty much climaxes with its cast of characters literally going to hell. It cranks out things like The Watcher in the Woods or The Black Cauldron. Some of these films which, you know, try to break away from the traditional Disney brand and sort of expand outwards and to maybe slightly more adult fare. Having said that, this is also a period of time in which animation in America in general made a running stab at trying to break out of being just family entertainment.
Well, yeah, because prior to Walt's death, I mean, animation, certainly in North America, and even in a global sense, you can argue to some degree, animated cinema is linked to Disney. Like, anytime a movie is made, people assume that it's Disney. They set the production blueprint, they set the aesthetic blueprint of what North American animated feature films ought to be. And then all of a sudden, you're right, there's this gap. They find themselves on shaky ground, and that's when we see not only Disney trying new things, but American and European animation studios also trying to take away part of that market.
Yeah, and at the most extreme ends, you get the very much for adult only type of animation coming out of here.
Which, what are we talking, Dave?
We're talking things like the works of Ralph Bashke, who's not exactly, I'll just say, he's a rather infamous individual for anybody who's...
His filmography is a roller coaster, more in terms of quality than excitement. But yeah, I mean, it's some of his work is very badly dated. Heavy Traffic still holds up, but he is making animated films decidedly for adults, proven by most of them carrying an X rating.
Yeah, or eventually giving us things such as Cool World, which is hands down one of the worst things I have ever seen. Well, we'll get there.
You're hearing that from the man who picked The Last Unicorn.
Yeah, yeah, oh, come on. Last Unicorn's quantum leaps beyond Cool World. So, but again, we'll get there one day. But yeah, so Bashke's probably the most noteworthy. Certainly he wasn't the only one involved with this. You end up getting things such as, you know, even I think Roger Corman ended up releasing one or two animated films like, what was it, Dirty Duck?
This time.
Yeah, you end up with... elements like that, you start to see an influx of animation from around the world kind of gradually making its way into the American market at this time.
Yeah, I'd say something like Heavy Metal would be a good indicator of that, only because the magazine's own art style is a lot of international collaborators in a weird sci-fi retro-future aesthetic. I know you're not a big fan of Heavy Metal, but that comes out 1981? Or 1983.
I want to say, I think it's 81. And I will say, I'm not a fan of Heavy Metal. I am very curious to revisit it, though. But it's also, I mean, at the same time, Nelvana, Canada's own beloved production company behind any number of animated specials and television shows, including the wonderful series The Raccoons of the 1980s. Even cranked out and gave us Rock and Rule, the much forgotten 1980s theatrical animated film, with which we have to talk about, Andrew. I think for a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, it's a film with, you know, music from Cheap Trick and starring Deborah Harry.
Doesn't Lou vocals. Reed voice a character?
He's in there as well. It's a wild piece. Not necessarily going to say good, but it's a wild piece.
But I mean, at this point in the 1980s, though, animation, which normally we used to think like cute animal protagonist singing a couple songs and learning a lesson about family, we see, yeah, like they're really pushing the limits on what was normally considered acceptable in animated form. And so I think that's so weird when we look at something like The Last Unicorn, because it seems narratively it's playing it very safe and isn't firmly Disney ground, but stylistically I think there's a bit more freedom to go outside of that.
Well, and I think this is where you and me will probably have some disagreement, because you're not wrong entirely, but I think there are shades of gray that certainly go with this movie that are make it far more fascinating than it probably would be otherwise. But, so yeah, so again, this film pretty much marked Rankin-Bass's effort to break into the theatrical market after spending years in television. I think the only thing that they had done that had gone theatrical prior to this was Mad Monster Party in the late 60s.
I don't know what that is.
It is a stop motion, sort of like their specials like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and that. In that sort of style, except it involves a party with all the famous monsters getting together. It's fascinating. Not necessarily, again, not necessarily good, but fascinating.
Is there alcohol served at this party?
I'm trying to remember whether there was or not in this film.
I'm just wondering if I can make a joke about Wallace and vomit.
Boo.
I deserve that. So The Last Unicorn.
Yeah, so basically this was their effort to take a running jump at getting into the theatrical game while Disney was sort of down on their luck. So I'm not entirely sure from what I can see about the background about how this particular production came together, but certainly at the end of the day, it ended up being written by Peter S. Beagle from his own book, as we acknowledged at the start there. They end up securing what is a pretty top-of-the-line voice cast for this thing.
Yeah, and in terms of its voice cast and its music, this is a film that's sort of hitting way above its average, it seems.
Yeah, because along with the cast, which we described earlier, we end up having Jimmy Webb on writing both the original score and writing original songs, which were performed by none other than America, the folksy rock band of the late 60s, early 70s, and into the 1970s, who you're probably
Sister Goldenhair fame.
Horse with No Name. Survival, Sister Daisy or Daisy Jane, like you probably
Muskrat
know their song.
Love.
Muskrat Love. True story. I actually once had to read A Winter's Tale in one go in one night. I had The Best of America playing in the background the entire time. They are now permanently linked in my head.
If you don't know who America is, ask your dad.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, again, they were sort of a more or less a duo. I'm not even sure really you could call them a band as such, who came together, sort of got into the sort of folk rock. You're probably, very familiar where it's very good, sort of guitar-driven, very mellow, I guess is the best way. Like, you're not, I mean...
They're not quite a hippie band, but they seem like they're maybe one skipped haircut away from getting there.
Pretty much. But, I mean, they are just, yeah, I mean, they had a fair number of hits. Like, they were not the sort of obscure band.
Yeah, they put America doing the songs on the film credits. People know who that is.
Exactly.
I still can't tell you who Junkie XL is.
one day we'll get there. But yeah, so we have them doing the credits. So honestly, they're going all out on this thing. They end up having the actual animation is done by, is sort of, I don't want to say outsourced, I guess, or maybe outsourced is the appropriate, term to use in this instance.
I think it's the only term that applies.
That's true. But in this case, it's done by Topcraft, which was a Japanese studio. basically whose members would go on, and for most parts to go on to become filmmakers themselves, and a good chunk of them would go on to form Studio Ghibli a few years. Now, I know, is it Ghibli or Ghibli? To me, Ghibli sounds right.
I always hear it said as Ghibli, but I can't tell you authoritatively.
Yeah, okay. I've heard it both ways. I prefer Ghibli myself, but at any rate, they also, shortly after this one, they would get, they would be hired to work on Miyazaki's Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind, which, if you haven't seen that film, folks, and you want to see some breathtaking animation, go watch that, because that film is amazing.
And you'll also learn why littering is bad for everyone.
Yeah. But, yeah, so going into this, you have this film that, you know, in terms of its pieces, really seems like they're making a real solid stab at going after the Disney market. And while it's safe to say that this film has a very dedicated cult following, it wasn't quite the breakthrough in 1982 that I think anybody hoped. Rankin Bass would end up going on to return to television, more or less. After this, we've described what happened to the Topcraft crew, and America remained just as awesome as they ever were, carrying forward.
Yeah, don't worry, those of you at home, America made it out okay.
Yes,
But let me put it to you this way, David, though.
Yeah.
We have all this attention being paid to production, to its design, to its sound, to its casting, and what is the film that we get about, though? I mean, with that top line of hitters, you need something that they can really sink their teeth into. What's the film about?
The story of The Last Unicorn is pretty much the personal quest and psychological growth of the titular Last Unicorn, voiced by Mia Farrow in this film. And the film is pretty much involves the unicorn after having a sort of gentle encounter with hunters coming into an enchanted forest where she lives, being posed with the question of, is she really the last unicorn? She doesn't really believe this herself, but has notably not seen others in quite some time. After an encounter with a rather eccentric butterfly, she finally decides to head off and try and find what happened to her brethren. Along the way, the film ends up being sort of divided into more or less three episodes, with the unicorn's quest taking her.
The unicorn's quest, David. All of this is to say that it's about a unicorn that wants to find other unicorns.
That is the short version of this, yes. But it is ostensibly
this film is about. Everything in the film is motivated by a unicorn deciding to go looking for other unicorns.
It is, but the thing about it is, and I can already see where you're kind of going with this, Andrew. I say that's a deceptively simple premise because...
Deceptively simple. Okay. I'll hear you out, but now that those of you at home know what actually happens in this film, go on, David. The three episodes of The Unicorn's Quest.
Pretty much it is an with the unicorn. The quest is divided into three sort of sections. First, in the initial stages of the encounter, is a moment when, you know, sleeping, she is captured by Mommy Fortuna, voiced by Angela Lansbury, this sort of decrepit witch who runs a traveling show that's pretty much conning people into seeing things that aren't real.
She's like Baba Yaga, you know, just the fairy tale old crone who's clearly up to no good.
Yes, and in this instance, we pretty much have a case where the unicorn is ultimately being disguised as a unicorn for the amusement of Fortuna's patrons, and which brings her into an encounter with Schmendrick the Magician, played by Alan Arkin.
I was going to say, I was hoping that would turn the film into like an animated version of North by Northwest, but no such luck.
Yes, so you have this initial segment built around the experiences of being within this sort of captive entertainment here. And then the second segment involves the encounter with a group of bandits led by Captain Cully.
Voiced by,
let me come back to my notes here. I forgot to write that one down.
Keenan Wynn.
Keenan Wynn, thank you. Who
doesn't sound at all like Keenan Wynn.
Yeah. But which pretty much involves, you know, Schmendrick, our sort of bumbling magician who isn't quite good at his craft, sort of encountering this group of, again, bandits who have built themselves up as sort of these mythic status that really does not reflect their reality as it is going forward. And then ultimately the third section involving King Haggard, played by Christopher Lee, and his son Prince Lur, voiced by Jeff Bridges, who, to answer your question, Andrew, as Haggard points out during the course of the film, he isn't biologically his son. He's just some urchin he picked up on the streets.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So that's why they don't sound alike. In fact, you could almost, I always have this weird There Will Be Blood connection.
I was going to say, that was the moment I was hoping it would turn into that movie as well.
stay tuned one day.
And then, then the unicorn beats Haggard to death with a bowling pin.
Yeah. As a result of this quest, though, at this point, the unicorn, in an effort, because they sort of discover along the way of the quest earlier in the film that all the other unicorns have basically been chased into the ocean by the Red Bull. In order to avoid the Red Bull's presence, and no, it's not a giant flying energy can.
I was going to say, it's weird that the horses didn't become Pegasus, because Red Bull gives you wings.
Indeed. But Schmendrick, in a moment of accidental magic, ends up turning the unicorn into a human woman.
She's beautiful.
But with a status which slow not only change moves the unicorn from her sort of detached, you know, sort of mystic immortal being into this more into a being that experiences both more the feeling of mortality, but also is unsure of what her status and identity is over the course of this, and comes to question the nature of her quest going forward, if she can even remember what it is. If that sounds, on one hand, I'm going to say up front, that sounds a little fragmented in places. And I was sure, Andrew, that that's probably something you would agree with.
Well, I mean, it kind of makes sense in a way. Like, my issue is not the plotting of this film necessarily. I mean, it's a fairy tale. It's an adventure story. And anyone who's taken, like, a 101 course in English Lit, you know, all stories follow similar patterns. And fairy tales, you know, they have their certain beats, they have certain archetypes that pop up, certain story functions that need to happen. They're all on display here, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I mean, it's not fragmented in the sense that things happen with no connection. Like, everything follows the main thread. Like, it's not an unfocused film, it's just a weird film.
It is a weird film, and I will admit as much, but it's a film, in case the listeners haven't figured out yet, I really like this movie. And I would say, be safe to say, Andrew, based upon much of what you've said so far, you were not as taken with it.
I'm still honestly trying to form an opinion of it, because I'm trying to think, like, in terms of its narrativity, the film is not fragmented, but there's something that just kind of, like, fails to come together for the film. And, I know I'm not articulating it very well. Like, I think if we look at the more concrete elements of it, it might come a bit more clear. But I think maybe where to start. You brought up at the beginning that this is a bunch of English animators from television working with a Japanese studio to make a film to challenge Disney. And I think that might explain why it's sort of uneven aesthetically.
Yeah, because even though I did praise the animation crew for their work on Nausicaä from a couple years after this movie, The Last Unicorn is, is fair to say, is not top drawer animation.
Well, and again, it doesn't have to be. It's more, it's not a budget issue. It's a production design issue, because it could not stop bothering me that the unicorn and the animals are animated in more of like, I don't want to say like the Japanese way, but there's sort of a softness to them, like movement is emphasized. But all the human figures, save for a few, are like these squat, cartoonish, like troll kind of looking people. And but then other people show up in the film that are like fully humanoid and like proportional in their bodies and that. And so the film, it's nice to look at, and some of the sequences are done very well, but like even with just the character modeling, there's something that doesn't come together, if that makes sense.
You're not, I can see where you're coming from on that. And the thing about it is, while I agree there is a way to see it as that, for me, it kind of works because
So, what about that works for you?
the thing about it is, with this film is, as I've sort of, acknowledged a couple times, this is not a Disney film. I mean, even though, again, the sort of base elements of this, you could easily see him being done as a Disney movie. This is a film with some darker themes, some more adult subject matter, that I don't think Disney at this time would probably have touched, for the
Probably
most
not,
part.
no.
No. And the thing about it is, while the animation at points is kind of TV-ish, I mean, there's certain points where you see the, poor lip movement and other elements, and I won't argue some of the detrimental qualities of that. There is something about this film that, because it doesn't quite gel, it gives it an eeriness that, whether intentional or not, really kind of gives it the feeling that this is something off and something a little more rough around the edges, both in terms of
Okay.
content and its design. And I think.
So it's like a sensibility that the film projects due to just its weird production history.
In part because of that, I think it's one of these things where, yeah, you can see these sort of elements that don't quite blend, but I mean, like this film, I mean, to me, yeah, I almost have to come back to the tone of this movie right from the get-go, because again, there's a version of this movie we could be describing that is this big rousing adventure story, and again, if you were talking about this as a Disney movie, there'd be the cutesy sidekicks and side characters, and that would be causing the laughter. That's not this movie at all. Even when you get sort of what's considered the funny characters, there is something either weird, maybe even grotesque at points, and very somber
Yeah,
about this movie
this is
because.
a morose movie. Like, most of the third act is spent with the characters moping while America sings sad songs.
Yeah, and I mean, right from the get-go, I mean, this is a film that's, again, it's prompted by, a couple hunters basically saying, like, okay, we really shouldn't be here, we shouldn't be hunting because all the unicorns have basically disappeared, and, oh yeah, by the way, we're gonna warn you, that last one that may or may not be there, yeah, don't come out of here because we will screw you up badly. And right from the moment you get there, this prompts not a quest in the sense of the unicorn saying, I need to go rescue everybody. It's just a simple question of, is there anybody else like me in existence? And it's this weird film where it's the real focus of this is more the titular unicorn's almost psychological development.
Yeah, like it's not a quest to necessarily become a hero as much as to understand yourself in an emotional sense. And like that's not to say it's a terribly complicated idea, but especially for 1982, like presumably family-oriented animation, that's a pretty dense subject, or that's one that doesn't lend itself so easily to the kinds of films that Disney was making at the time.
Well, yeah, and I mean, this is a film that goes out of its way to sort of not be comforting in many ways, because ostensibly, what does our unicorn learn by the end? This is a character who goes from, I don't ex feel regret and remorse. I mean, I can feel sorrow, and by the end of this film, basically, it's come to, I understand what regret is. I understand what it is to lose something,
But also
and.
what it is to love.
Yeah, and but I mean, it's not like, again, in the Disney version of this, the unicorn would be turned back into a human again, and or separated into both, be, so it could be both unicorn and human, and everybody lives happily ever. That's
Until
not
a
this
rapping
movie.
genie saves the day.
Yeah, no, in this instance, the unicorn basically becomes human, slowly kind of loses her mind, falls in love, And then ultimately, because by nature of the situation and what has to happen, becomes a unicorn again. And, you know, all of a sudden it's like, well, I mean, we can't be, you know, we can't be together in this status because this is what I am. But damn, I now feel, you know, that I've lost something that was important that I didn't know about prior to this. And the film pretty much postulates that, yeah, that's part of life. Get used to it, kids.
Pretty much. And I mean, like, that's a valid lesson to teach kids. It's just, it's odd. Even Inside Out, you know, doesn't quite come off that, like, bluntly, I guess. Because this is Life's Not Fair, the movie. And again, like, if they were doing it sort of ironically or making, like, a film about adult issues in a children's aesthetic, like, I can see that working. If they made, like, a more sensitive or, like, youth-oriented film about, hey, bad things are going to happen, but that's okay. You'll survive it, and life goes on. We got to keep trying, you know? That would work as well. But instead, like, this film has some... I wouldn't say it's disturbing imagery, but there is an eeriness to the image quality. Like, a lot of the scenes even if I don't really like how the animation plays out, like, the images themselves are pretty evocative. It's all about, like, sort of late teen, early adult kind of themes, but at the same time, like, there's still that cutesiness to it with some of the characters, or there's that reliance on, like, slapsticky gags and that. And so really, it's, like, the kind of audience that this film wants to be for doesn't really exist.
But again, I almost kind of appreciate that, you know, tension that exists between those two elements here. But
it's not smart enough to be, like, an interesting film for adults. But it's also too morose and somber to be or requires a bit more nuance. And maybe I'm missing out on some of that myself, but it doesn't work purely for children either. Now, I didn't watch this with my own daughter. Timing didn't allow for that. And I'm like, well, I don't know. I would be very curious to see what her response to that would be. But, you know, I still can't figure out what I think about it.
Well, and this is kind of what I appreciate, because it's not an easily pegged down film. I mean, even aspects of it, because when we say it's pushing the boundaries of adult, because it's both in terms of both these very dark themes. I mean, even, you know, towards the end of this film, you know, there's characters who point out that, you know, there's no such thing as happy endings because nothing never really ends. This idea that, you know, life just keeps going and going and going. And, you know, if you take that to its logical conclusion, it's ultimately, and the only end is death. And beyond that, who can say? Which, again, I kind of appreciate that bluntness. But even then, you get there's some dark stuff going on in the film, and some more complex stuff going on with what, because one of the things I noted in the notes that you put down in the doc here, Andrew, was that there isn't really an antagonist, and I'm kind of happy that there isn't, at least not in the traditional sense, because what the Unicorn and her crew more or less come up against is a series of complicated villains that aren't easily solved in the way that you would say. I mean, there's no, and the evil queen must be defeated, and the whole land will be happy again.
And
no,
like, structurally, that, to me, seems very at odds with most fairy tales or heroic journey cycles. Only because, yeah, normally there could be multiple antagonists, but usually it'll progress and ramp up to the one big bad. Here, we have a bunch of disparate antagonists. And I'm saying antagonist rather than villain because, like, Mama Fortuna is a bit of a different story, but I don't know if King Haggard does anything that I would say, like, rises to the level of villainy necessarily. Like, and I think maybe this speaks to your point, Dave, where, you know, it's not that it's terribly in-depth, but the characters are complicated enough that they sort of resist that classification that most literary modes of reading this kind of story would assume are there.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, with Fortuna, I mean, basically, she's not this grandiose witch villain that you would find. She is this broken down, basically hustler, you know, running this stage show. And her big thing for her is that she has a real harpy in her show that she's managed to capture. And everybody keeps pointing out to her, it's like, you know, no, you shouldn't have that thing chained up. I mean, it's disrespectful to it. And again, that's kind of
this. Come on, Mama. It's Chekhov's harpy just waiting to happen.
And her entire point is like, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if it gets out and it kills me. Because guess what? I did it. I dominated that thing, even for a short time. You can't take that away from me. Which is such a fascinating motivation in the back of my mind, where the goal here isn't to have total dominance on this thing forever. It's just the matter of being able to kick it when it's down and say, I got you at some point and you can't take that away.
Yeah. It's I've attained this brief moment of mastery, and even if it ends right now, you can't say that I didn't do it.
Well, exactly. And there's something really sinister about that, particularly how it plays into these themes of the idea of both, you know, the way which, you know, mankind sort of relates to nature, that seems to be the ongoing subtext of this movie, on how we sort of choose to dominate and abuse it and not recognize it for what it is. Because one of the great things throughout this film is there is this recurring idea of what is the distinction between real and fantasy and fiction. And, you know, ultimately, if you can't tell the difference, does it matter? Because again, Fortuna, you know, basically is conning everybody for the most part, having these sickly abused animals, you know, appearing as these mythic creatures, except for like the two that she has that are real. And the one that is real, she still has to disguise it because nobody can recognize it for what it is. And this thing is, that's some pretty heady stuff for what is ostensibly a kid's film. And again, the way in which this one ends, it pretty much comes down to the unicorn freeing the harpy because, you know, it should be free. This thing then goes out of its way to basically eat and kill.
Yeah, he Fortuna. Threatens the unicorn, and then he eats Fortuna and Fortuna's assistant. And again, like, this isn't like the climax of the film or something. This is something that happens 30 minutes in. And yeah, like, it's just, yeah, the flow of the story is weird, so moments that should be very impactful, well, they happen, just not where you expect them to. Yeah. And then there's all this lag time in between. It's weird. Like, and again, like, in talking about with you, like, I think I'm getting a better sense of why this film prompts such a strange reaction from me, but I think that, yeah, it's just, I was expecting something like that to happen, or, you know, retribution to be done. I wasn't expecting a lot of close-ups of, like, this horrible monster, like, swooping down on people, and then this like, really horrid shot from the back of it, like, lurched over a prone body and, like, moving its mouth.
Well, in doing that, and then having Fortuna, right before this happens, like, with giddy glee, just like, she's gonna die. She's not caring. She literally is welcoming it at this point. You know, how many villains in a, you know, again, in family entertainment films welcome death with open arms like this? I'm not even sure if I can think of another one quite like that.
And
this
But film, are we collating doing something interesting with doing something that has quality?
To me, it is, because it's not. Again, I find that kind of comforting, because this is a film that resists, as you've sort of acknowledged, these easy and comforting tropes. This is a film that goes out of its way to, yeah, you can solve situations or you can get out of it. And it's not necessarily going to make you happy or necessarily resolve anything. Because again, the Fortuna sequence comes to an end and Schmendrick is left, you know, sort of devastated by the fact that, yeah, two people are dead because of what I've done. And the unicorn's initial reaction is like, I mean, it's like, hey, it's not on me.
What's the quote? I feel sorrow, but no regret.
Exactly. And that's one of those things where it's like, okay, that's a pretty strong ethical and moral question to start raising, you know, in this film right off the get-go. And
but how can... Here's a moral question for you. How can a unicorn not be aware of the finitude of mortality while at the same time being, like, actively complicit in the death of two people?
And, well, again, I think this is one of the things that's interesting about this film is the way in which it treats the notion of magic and magical beings as there is this detachment. I mean, you know, they are not human as such. And I mean, if you want to start getting into the sort of mythic subtext of it, you know, if we view the unicorn as a god figure that ultimately, you know, descends from its, you know, mystical, you know, its heaven-like place, this protected enchanted forest, comes down into the lowly world of the bleakness and desecrated land of mankind, which everybody has to eke out this horrible living, eventually becomes human. In order to, you know, whether by choice or not, ultimately this happens to it and comes to understand what it means to be, to live as a human. So, I mean,
I'm going
to
stop you right there, Dave. If you invert that plot description, you also just described Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen. But I think that speaks to the point where it's like, that is, I mean, it's interesting how it's presented, or maybe just how it comes off, because I don't know how deliberate, like, that detachment is. In a story sense, yes, but it's certainly not helped by Mia Farrow.
Well, yeah, we'll get to... Yeah, I'm not going to say that the execution's perfect here. Don't get me wrong. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying it's more
But you're right. I mean, like, thematically and morally, that is not something you would expect from children's cinema, especially when you're trying to make it into the mainstream and, like, make your run at Disney. But it seems like in order to, make this film stand out, they almost had to push it to a place where it would alienate youth audiences.
And while I admit, from a commercial standpoint, that's probably wasn't the wisest choice they could have made, I'm kind of happy that this exists because of it, because there is something, I think this is a film that is very interesting, I mean, as a work of cinema that is ostensibly aimed at kids, and how it sort of pushes those boundaries, and how it is definitely, you know, pushing this, you know, okay, I know you're used to sort of the safe and comforting, you know, films of Disney, but here, I'm going to remind you, yeah, what Disney's selling you isn't necessarily the way the world is.
It's like going to the Stratford Music World, where you'd go to their Japanimation VHS section, and there you can be like, okay, do I want 3 episodes of Pokemon, or, oh, what's this, Ninja Scroll? Sounds pretty cool. Perfect Blue, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to come off as I'm saying that animated cinema has to be only one thing, because if there's one thing I learned just growing up with it and studying it, it's that animation is just as diverse and varied as, you know, live action cinema. It can do things in its own way and, like, has its own formal patterns and things it can do that live action cannot, and vice versa. So I'm not trying to critique this film because it can't easily be buttonholed into a genre. But it seems like with all the trappings in that and the book status as, like, youth fiction, it seems weird that most of what they're doing thematically and narratively is aimed for an older audience. And I'm saying that, well, I mean, the effects were interesting, but that kind of dooms the film outright. But I think more problematic is the fact that that speaks to this film doesn't really know what it wants to be.
And I'm not sure I entirely agree with that, because, I mean, this is, to me, it is rather thematically and dramatically coherent in what it aims to be. There's some clunkiness to the execution, no question about that.
But then there's other things that are thrown in that are just dumb and grating, and they feel like they're there solely to appeal to kids in the audience.
Okay, so let's get into this. So okay, what are some, like, of these things?
All right, when the unicorn first comes out in the human world, and that guy, like, creepily undoes his belt and approaches her, and he's trying to call her, and then she knocks him over, and he then looks, and, like, there's a 10-second bit of him being like, oh, that horse is truly a fast one. I seem to have fallen down. Or, like, a lot of the stuff with Schmendrick is, I mean, I laugh at some of it because it's Alan Arkin, but a lot of it feels like it's more juvenile, slapsticky humor. And then the whole thing with Robert Klein as the butterfly is just weird. Where, yeah, he's a talkative butterfly that also makes like weirdly suggestive motions towards the unicorn's horn while speaking exclusively in folk and contemporary song lyrics.
I almost wonder if that's supposed to be a running go at Disney there itself and their sort of jokey side characters. Because I like the fact that shows up, disappears after that point, never to return.
But
In
what
the movie.
value is there in putting an irritating character in a film simply to be irritating? Because if you succeed, you have now irritated your audience.
And I guess the feeling is I didn't find it as irritating.
It's just that sequence goes on for like 5 minutes.
Oh, it's over long. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it is. It could have easily been cut down by about a good solid 2 minutes,
Like
easily.
it doesn't go anywhere. And I think that's, I mean, eventually there is, yeah, the reveal that, oh, by the way, the Red Bull chased all the unicorns into the ocean. And that prompts it, but like, you know, I guess we've talked about it before, but like sort of serial narrativity, like classic adventure films, Star Wars, I think is, you know, a good go-to example where it is sort of episodic and disparate, but within every scene there's a clear thrust to it. And I feel like, yeah, this film doesn't have that same level of focus within the scenes themselves, if that makes sense.
And I could see that being the case. I think for me, ultimately, the sort of inner psychology that's going on and the sort of character arc that we see with the unicorn, it's herself, to me, holds it together. So, I mean, the film is episodic. It does lose focus at points. And I think part and parcel of it probably is, I would imagine, this film only runs about 88 minutes in length. My guess is probably reading Beagle's, if I were to read Beagle's original novel, there's probably be a solid 2 to 2.5 hour film more than likely in there. Because I can imagine some of there is far more detail and far more episodes probably along the way that were streamlined down for this film,
Yeah,
version.
the Tom Bombadillo scenes.
Well, it could be. I mean, I could be wrong. I'm willing to admit that, but it
Well, I mean,
is.
fantasy by nature is usually pretty sprawling and episodic, so I'm sure there was probably something cut from the novel, because otherwise it sounds like a pretty boring novel.
Well, and this is the thing, but and this is kind of where, again, coming back to like episode three of this film, I'm really kind of fascinated because you would assume, again, in another film, they come to the kingdom of King Haggard, and it would be the sort of, you know, desolate, dark empire that he reigns over with an iron fist. And you get there, and it is basically this hollowed out, you know, kingdom that has just become so decrepit that it's literally just the king and his adopted
Yeah,
son.
it's not like the avaricious monarch that's he's grown fat because he stole from the people. Instead, it's a sad old man in a sad old castle. And yeah, again, that's something you wouldn't expect to see, nor would you expect it to play out with like talking about joy and emotions and how no, the King Haggard's real problem is that he's depressed.
Yeah, and I mean, on top of this, I mean, he's somebody who cannot rec. I mean, this is a film that's very much about the notion of, well, what does it even mean to be happy at the end of the day? Because you have, you know, Haggard, who literally has no idea what's really going to make him happy throughout this film. So he just burns through these things, and the only joy he seems to get out of it basically is, you know, literally, again, I'm sure Laura Mulvey would have a field day with the gaze in terms of how it applies to him and the fact that his entire pleasure in this film comes from what is he looking at? And what he wants to look at is these unicorns trapped under the sea by this weird red bull of his. So he can be this greedy little SOB and just stare at them to hell with everybody else.
Yeah, there's that sense of like there is no plan for the antagonist in this film. They just it's like that line Deadwood where Wild Bill basically just with like the perfect Carradine sigh just says, "Will you at least go? Will you at least be quiet and let me go to hell my own way?" And I think that's the attitude that almost every antagonist in this film has, that attitude. Even Cully, who's not overly like villainous or anything, he just has that, meh, what does it matter? This is what I want to do. But like for some reason in the film's third episode, I will say that I found this to be the most enjoyable part of the film. I think it's the most interesting, and I think this is the problem is that if the theme of the film is the unicorn learning like the human world and learning how to deal with loss, learning how to deal with regret, grappling with mortality, that's fine. But the part of the film that only really engages with those themes happens an hour into the movie.
I would say probably the I would again debate it a little bit in terms of the echoes between the Mommy
Like,
Fortuna
the
stuff
early parts
and
certainly touch on those themes. I'm not saying that they don't, but like when it emerges clearly that this is what this film is really about, and like it actually takes the time to address these issues in a greater degree of detail, because at the end of the day, this still is, ostensibly a children's film. The third episode is the only place where it gives it time to breathe and it gives time for ideas to develop. Otherwise, it just kind of comes off as sloganeering. Like it's making statements, but it's not building them up to be meaningful. And that only happens in the third episode, which again, it's like, that's fine, but why is there an hour of more or less filler before it?
And I would say, and again, I have a hard time describing everything that hour preceding as filler because it strikes me as not only setting up these things, but again, positioning the characters in very particular places in terms of their reactions and beliefs and things, which changed over time. Now, the Cully sequence, I would say that's probably one that could have easily been cut from the film. That one it feels the most tangential. For the most part, I mean, I see what they're going for with the whole, this disconnect between Cully seeing himself as this sort of, romantic bandit figure and his sort of continued dismissal of Robin Hood as myth. It's not something that's real, as a way to sort, and this sort of contrasting between the reality that he exists in with the fantasy that everybody seems to want out of it.
But I guess that's the thing. If the film keeps evoking images and situations where there's duplicity or use of illusion, but like it does so negatively in the sense that Cully sort of has this idea of himself that doesn't match, everybody else's idea of the Robin Hood figure, Mama Fortuna explicitly, and even Haggard, where there's the misdirection of identity. These are all sort of bad things, or the film presents them as negative. So we might be tempted to take a reading of like, oh, well, it's teaching us that it's essence, not appearance, that matters. But at the same time, Schmendrick's whole role in the film is to get people out of troubled situations by creating illusions. And especially in the Cully sequence, it's even weirder because he's a hypocrite because he doesn't measure up to this idea of heroism or the vigilante or, the noble highwayman, but it's all resolved because Schmendrick uses a spell to create a fictional Robin Hood that all these grown men suddenly go, hey, look, it's Robin Hood, and run away after him. So it's basically saying illusions are bad, but they're also good sometimes.
Well, and I think this almost begs the question. I mean, to come back to this film, or even if its underpinnings are very traditionally fantasy, in essence, I mean, is this film sort of almost taking a poke in at fantasy and the sort of traditional sort of
I think you're being entirely too generous on that point.
I mean, it could, and I'm not saying maybe I'm not being, but it feels to me that there is something there, but there is a commentary going on about the way in which, we the sort of heroism and ideals of fantasy are that are communicated through traditional fantasy works. I mean, because again, even one of the key points here is this entire sequence where Lur is trying to win the unicorn's hand while she's a human being and trying to get her to even pay attention to him, goes through this whole, montage of the great heroic acts that win people, and it doesn't matter. None of it measures up to anything.
Though we get to see, like, a remarkable-looking dragon that wouldn't have been out of place on the 60s Fantastic Four series.
Yeah, it's very true. But I think that's the thing. There is quite a bit of sort of... I mean, the fact that this is a film, it seems to be undercutting those fantasy tropes and these notions of, you know, sort of romantic heroism. I mean, again, our heroes are... When you boil it down to, it is a unicorn basically trying to fly, you know... figure out, you know, going through an identity crisis and, you know, who they are and where they belong. You have a magician who is inept and by no stretch of the imagination a conventional hero as such.
But that's not necessarily unique to this film.
It isn't unique to this film.
The problem is, Dave, I think this film, you're reading it as somewhat like self-reflexive and subversive to an extent. Like,
yeah.
Subversive more in the sense of what it's doing with form. And it's not that I'm saying you're wrong. It's just that I think only about half of this film aggregate could qualify for that. Because the other half seems to be like the more presumably youth-oriented parts of it. It's a lot more facile. It's a lot more like that kind of Disney film than maybe you would like to admit. It's just the problem is it really feels like two uneven halves. It's not even a hour one, hour two divide. It's just there are all these little like internal tensions that ever really keep it from taking shape as one or the other. And again, that wouldn't necessarily be a problem, but I think to try and position this film as like as a project, this film in total is about subverting those archetypes, I think is being far too generous.
And perhaps is. I think part of what it goes for me is for me, it's the to come back to the word you use, the tensions that exist within this movie, I think are what fascinated me about it. Because I admit, it's not a 100% successful endeavor. I think there is quite a bit of stuff, both technically and in terms of the scripting of it, that do fall flat. Turning our attention to the cast, I think one of the problems is we have an all-star cast, but this isn't, say, an all-star cast working in 2018, where, let's be honest, you know, a lot of Hollywood actors, you know, they do voice work now on a fairly regular basis. At this time, traditionally, even in Disney films, you didn't too often see major stars suddenly signing up and playing these roles.
Yeah, there would be one or two, like, featured voice performers, but then the rest of it would be like the internal studio crew for all the bit players.
Well, and this is the thing, and so you've got, you know, people like Angela Lansbury and Christopher Lee, who are such old pros, and, you know, both come out of stage training and, you know, really tend to emphasize their voice. They come
and apparently I did discover while doing some research that the film's German language track, Christopher Lee can speak fluent German, so he did his own lines in the German release.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
It does not surprise me at all either.
And that's the thing. And I think, actually, if I'm not mistaken, I was looking through some of the research. I think Chris Lee, for years, wanted to do a live-action take on this where he would finally play King Haggard in real life, or in a live-action interpretation of this once he was age-appropriate for the role. Obviously, that didn't happen before his passing.
I can't wait to wait 40 years to make this. I'll settle for being Willy Wonka's dad.
Pretty much. But yeah, no, I mean, they come across well, and I mean, they really know what they're doing. Arkin...
Yeah,
and...
Lee in particular, I think, is the standout in this film.
Yeah. I mean, he knows the strengths of his voice, and he knows how to utilize it. Alan Arkin and Jeff Bridges are less comfortable. I would say both are good, but... at points, and there's moments where they really click, but there are other times you get the feeling they were probably shown the script like half an hour beforehand and are in the recording booth, and this is their first time doing it and are not entirely sure whether this is going to work or not.
Well, it's like Bridges comes off as very blasé and sort of very, very flat and unexpressive. And I mean, that's fine because as we alluded to earlier, Mia Farrow certainly has a large part of this film being flat and unexpressive. But the difference is Prince Lear doesn't actually learn anything. Like, he doesn't have a journey as a character that shakes him out of that. He's very much the dude, except younger.
Well, I'm not even sure I'd go that far because, I mean, at least the dude has a more distinct personality than what Bridges brings to the role here.
Valid point.
Because, I mean, the thing about Lear is he is, again, an interesting character on paper in terms of this is a guy who, you know, again, you know, he would be in a traditional Disney film, the heroic prince who comes in at the last minute, saves the day, and goes off with the princess at the end. Here, you know, he, you know, meets, you know, his love interest, falls in love, and ultimately has to kind of accept that, yeah, this is never going to happen.
Well, he also dies and comes back. Gloss over that.
This is also true. But yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, unless this film wanted to go down some really, really weird, dark NC-17 territory, yeah, that relationship was never going to work, and would probably have opened the floodgates for all sorts of fun criticism.
It all starts here, folks.
But they seem on the relatively shaky ground, and Mia Farrow, like, I go back and forth, because I think the early parts of this movie, she works quite well. Because there is that sort of detached quality that's supposed to be part of the character, she really does effectively communicate.
But I think that's a happy accident more than anything. Maybe she's just that bad at singing. It's just because, yeah, it's that weird resonance where, you know, as sort of like the creature of myth not understanding the human world, when you're staring at everything going, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if I am truly the last unicorn. You know, it's just, like, it's fine. Like, I get it, but it certainly makes the film seem a lot longer than it is.
Well, like I said, I enjoy your performance up until, once she becomes human, then it begins, she's supposed to have her sort of psychological trauma going on. She's less effective at communicating. And then when she gets her and Jeff Bridges get their big musical duet together. Oh, man.
That made me so sad because, the track in question, That's All I've Got to Say. It's a love duet, you know. They finally recognize it, and to show their undying passion, it's like both of them ate a handful of Zopaclone and chased it down with, like, a fifth of whiskey, and then decided to get up for open mic. Which is a shame, because pretty much most of the other, I think there's one or two outside of that, and there's like a dozen songs in this film. The majority of them, though, are sung, like, extra diegetically by America.
Yeah.
This is one of the few songs where it is sung, like, diegetically by characters in the film. And when you hear the contrast, it is abysmal.
Oh yeah, no, there's no saving that sequence. And I say, and again, if I'm coming across as an apologist, this is one of those points where I'm not apologizing, because yeah, it's bad. Like, they just can't, I'd be curious to know whether either of them had any actual vocal training for singing, because it,
well, like, Jeff Bridges would, because he won the Oscar for Crazy Heart. Maybe, yeah, he learned from this.
Well, that might very well be the case. I mean, who knows? They could have shown up and it's like, oh, we have to sing a song? Shoot, we got 15 minutes prep time. What are we going to do? But yeah.
And then Alan Arkin pokes his head and he's like, hey kids, I'll help you do vocal warm-ups.
See, and that's the other thing I do actually kind of appreciate about this movie. Because there are things, again, in terms of sort of not being traditional fantasy.
Alan Arkin plays like a teenager. That's non-traditional.
Well, it's not only non-traditional, but I love the fact that, you know, in a film like this, traditionally, it would probably be cast with either English actors or actors capable of, you know, communicating a English accent. They don't even try with Bridges or Arkin in this movie. They just, it's like, nope, they are strictly American.
Exactly.
We're not, like, gonna,
we're just going to go one speed here. But the problem is, it's that the dialogue is all your fantasy tropes. And, like, with Schmendrick, it's particularly notable because, first off, his voice is somewhere like 25 years easy older than he's supposed to be. But also, it's Alan Arkin, and I love Alan Arkin. I love the sound of his voice. He should not be given lines like, oh, I'm just a traveling magician trying to find a unicorn. You know, it's just, Like, oh man, it's just when you suddenly put him in a room with Christopher Lee and it's all, I will retain you into my service. Cool. I guess I better not tell him about that unicorn. It just, it doesn't, like, it becomes too ridiculous. And, like, I think that's the problem. Like, there are tensions in this film, but there are moments where the tensions cease to be productive and then they just become displacing.
And
And, like, it breaks the film at these points.
I
This is a
won't
broken film.
I won't say that the overall film is broken, but you're not wrong about some of what you're saying here. I will not disagree at all. Having said that, though, I will say there is one other voice actor in this film who does a bang up job and whose work I really enjoyed,
Hit
and
me
that
with
is
it.
Renee Auber Jononis. Once again, I'm pretty sure I just botched his name. Making his second appearance on this podcast
For those
after.
keeping score.
Yeah, who plays the skeleton? That's
Auberginois. That's how I'd say it. One day we'll
Auberginois.
figure it out. He's bound to show up again at this rate.
Yeah, very much true. But his performance is as the skeleton who, again, coming back to that idea of reality and fantasy, this idea, you know, he just wants to have a drink of wine. Doesn't matter that he can't taste it. Or even recognize that it's not there. He just wants that wine and will be satisfied when he gets it. Again, there is something. His vocal performance is just great. I mean, he's clearly having the time of his life.
He's a skeleton yelling for strangers to give him wine,
Yeah.
David. How great can you be at that?
You can
It's
be
so.
pretty. You can be pretty great. Like I said, I
Like,
appreciate
you
the
can tell
small
he's having
things.
fun, but it leads to a scene that, again, is like probably twice as long as it needs to be of us watching a skeleton pretend to drink wine from an empty bottle. Like, what's happening?
What's happening is I'm finding great amusement, and having a blast watching this ridiculous sequence. But yeah, no, I would say he again, at least he seems comfortable doing voiceover work of this sort, if nothing else. Whether you like his, you know, think that there's much merit to the short performance he gives or not, we'll put the pin in that for now and say
It's
yes.
distinctive, I'll give him that.
Yeah. Oh, and at least we forget Brother Theodore in this movie, as
Is it
Rook.
Roke? Ruick.
Rook, or something like that, yeah. You to tell us how you pronounce it. And yeah, Brother Theodore, very distinctive voice, really doesn't get a hell of a lot to do in this movie, at all.
Yeah, he's there to oh, and it's so funny because when Schmender's like, I kept them occupied by telling them a riddle, I'm like, let me guess. Let me guess. And I totally called it, when is a raven like a writing desk?
Oh, God, yeah.
But again, like that speaks to, I mean, it makes sense in that it's still the realm of children's fantasy. And I mean, like, it's my complaint again is not that the film has odd touches, because when you break down any fairy tale or like classic adventure, like, there are a whole lot of bits of it that do not make any sense said out loud. You
Yeah.
know, but it all works on the same kind of logic. And like, this film, even in its telling, it does maintain that kind of logic. The problem is there are just moments where, as a film itself, like things just go awry, and that's those moments where it really pulls me out of it.
And I can respect that. I think ultimately my appreciation of it comes down to the way a lot to how it does veer from where it diverges from the sort of standard fantasy tropes and from so much of the sort of conventionalized way in which fantasy is now depicted in contemporary film. Because one of the things that, you know, it is sort of the same thing we've seen with the superhero genre in recent years. Because I love the fact that we're in this golden era of it. Do not get me wrong, but there is something I kind of miss about the freewheeling late 80s and into the 90s where, again, the studios don't really have a finger on the genre yet. They don't know quite what they're doing. So you ended up with some really strange adaptations and choices
Yeah.
made in those movies
And like
that.
the logic is we know what audiences don't want anymore. Now we have a few years before we go bankrupt to figure out what they do.
Well, and this is exactly it. I mean, this is kind of one of the things. I think there is something about the way in which this film, yeah, how it plays with magic, how it plays with, you know, I mean, again, this is a film without many major set pieces. Like, you would think, oh, there's magic and fantasy, that there'd be all these big elaborate things. There isn't. Really, the big showdown is a giant flaming red bull and a unicorn headbutting each other on a beach. And that, on one hand, that sounds terrible. On the other hand, I kind of appreciate the relative mellowness of that compared to what
up until
see.
Like a couple thousand unicorns ride out on waves,
which is actually a very well done sequence, I might add.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that one is kind of awesome. I like the way in which it sort of picks and chooses its moments to be sort of audacious. And again, you know, to come back to, it's not quite as, say, let's go back to Ralph Bashke's Lord of the Rings for a minute. One of the things I love about Bashke's Lord of the Rings that I prefer well over the Peter Jackson version is how trippy it is. I mean, again, I like the Jackson movies, don't get me wrong, but big wizard battles basically come down to two dudes throwing light shows at each other.
Well, verisimilitude is also relaxed because it's animated, and that allows for a certain kind of expressiveness that you can't capture profilmically.
Well, yes, but I think there is something about, I mean, the it's not quite art house in terms of what he's doing in that film.
It's very unique, though, because that's the blend of cel shading and rotoscoping, right?
Yeah, and it really, there's just some stuff, like when you see Saruman and Gandalf interacting in that film, and you sort of see, like, the background shifting in these weird patterns behind him. It's like, okay, this is, I'm down with this. This is interesting and kind of, I mean, appropriately off-putting in a way that I dig. And Last Unicorn is never that extreme by any stretch of the imagination. But again, there are these sort of quiet things where, yeah, things are just a little off and a little weird. Some of it comes from the rough around the edges animation. And then there's other things that where it's just choices. Like the unicorn becomes, when the unicorn becomes human, for example, the transformation is kind of eerie. And also particularly the fact that, again, in what is ostensibly a children's film, they're not hiding the fact that there is kind of very super brief nudity involved in this. Again, in the Disney version, you know, a magical flowery dress would have appeared out of nowhere.
I can see some studio mogul being like, it's okay, it's about purity.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, I mean, you're right there. And I think this film is very selective sort of when it kicks into high gear, but those sequences largely work. And I think, I just feel like, given the fact that they were sort of an outside studio trying to make a big impact and, like, make a glossier production, I feel like there was a conversation at one point where they're like, well, what would we rather have in this movie? Lip-syncing or all the unicorns coming out on the waves to drown the flaming Red Bull elemental? We're like, okay, show of hands. All right, we're doing the last scene. So I feel like concessions had to be made. I think, like, by the end of the film, it's writ large because instead of like some of the really interesting and ornate scenes from earlier, like the opening credits is a good counterexample. This the film's closing credits are literally like a still frame of animation. And it's just the camera moving to different quadrants of it and zooming. Like, nothing actually moves. And I think that's kind of fitting, where it's like, okay, well, we got to the end of the film, and we're completely out of money, so we gotta find a way to make this work. But if it meant that they got to have the big moments, and those big moments were successful, there's something kind of admirable about that.
Hey, here's the funny thing. I know you're really just going to groan when I say this. I actually kind of like those ending credits and how very rudimentary they are. Because there is something, again, because it ends up almost being more of a, it's more about the atmosphere in which you're leaving the film than it is any additional piece of information. I kind of like the somberness of, yeah, it's just still images that we're sort of focusing on at this point as we're sort of melodically taken out of the film to, once again, the very mellow and not quite downbeat, but certainly getting their music of America on the soundtrack here. Again, it's that kind of little weird details that work for me. And I admit, one of the things we'll probably discover about, that I think people will discover about me as we watch the show, is I kind of like dissonance between things that we're watching. Like, I'm one of those suckers who, again, never say never again. I love the opening credits with the completely seemingly out of place music and the violent imagery that's taking place there. I think that's amazing, and it actually kind of works for me in a way that other people seem turned off by. And I admit, I'm kind of freakishly alone on that, but I can't help it.
Well, I mean, I really like sort of weirdness in films. I like the dissonance as well. I guess I feel like it needs to add up to something, or after a point it sort of reaches critical mass where it's like, oh, well, these interesting subtextual moments are happening out of haphazardness and accident rather than anything deliberate. And I think when you're structuring it to be a certain way, that's really interesting, like on an analytical level. Otherwise, though, when it leads to moments where, like, you're just pulled out of the film, or the film, like, tempers its own ability to, like, talk about emotions in a complex way, like, when it's undercutting that and the actual aims of the film, then I think it's a little more problematic. And, I mean, this film, you will definitely see things that you don't usually see in other films of its ilk. But that's not enough for me to say that it's a good movie or terribly worth watching.
And I can respect it. I would certainly go to bat for this film saying it's at least worth a single viewing, if nothing else. But, I mean,
well, it's a good reminder that the Disney style is not, it's not the only form of animation there is. And I think, to some extent, Pixar, the current juggernaut of the marketplace, like, they've demonstrated that it's possible to make films that they don't allow for just, like, a hybridized reading, but at one and the same time, they can make a film that has sort of, like, I don't want to say superficial, but sort of an easier-to-unpack message and jokes and, you know, an actual arc with development aimed for a youth audience, while at the same time having, like, a separate emotional register and arc aimed for adult ones, and both of them are satisfying. That doesn't, you know, that effort, or trying to sort of split the difference between the two demographics going to family movies, that doesn't begin with Pixar either, as we can see here. Like, it doesn't work, but they're certainly attempting to do something like that.
Well, no, and that's the thing. I mean, I'm fully willing to admit that I'm probably giving it far too much credit and being far too forgiving of some of its flaws. But this is one of those cases where I can see they are going for something. They're very much a sort of go big or go home vibe about this movie. And I kind of have a hard time not appreciating what it is that what they're aiming to do, even if they're not quite hitting it. On the whole. Now, that said, I mean, I could easily see another take at this material again, and I'm sure in due time,
I'm pretty sure it's safe to say that there have been many takes at this thing, just not called The Last Unicorn.
This is true, but I would say that this story itself, and probably Beagle's novel, will get adapted again at some point. Probably, I mean, right now it's in sort of a low tide with the sort of previous fantasy wave kicked off by Lord of the Rings having sort of receded in recent years. But I'm sure it'll be another few years, and I'm sure it'll kick up again, and then people are going to go searching for material to adapt.
Yeah, and then everyone on the internet's going to freak out when they cast Idris Elba as the unicorn. Sometimes David, we shouldn't look back, David.
Yeah.
We can't feel regret, only sorrow.
Indeed, indeed. So I guess that brings us to Hits and Pits, the patent-pending segment of this program. I believe at this point that the patent has been filed. We've also been given a restraining order from the patent office. But
yeah, apparently if you keep filing for the same one, it doesn't make it extra secure. It just means they yell at you for being frivolous.
Indeed. But I guess, you know, with this that said, I guess, Andrew, what hits haven't we necessarily discussed that you would like to sort of tip your hat to, if any?
Honestly, like, I think we've been, like, more thorough than I was expecting on The Last Unicorn. Give a special shout out to the title track of the film performed by America. Not necessarily because I liked it, but because it's been stuck in my head for the last 36 hours.
So
clearly it's an effective earworm.
Yeah.
No, I think more seriously, the film score is very well done. I think Jimmy Webb has like one of those weird distinctions where he's the only person to win like a Grammy as a performer, a lyricist, and doing the orchestration or something like that. He knows what he's doing with this score, and thankfully, America, they know what they're doing when they play their songs. So it gives that weird, you know, almost like The Wicker Man, where there's something serene and pastoral about it, even though most of the songs have like a haunting quality to them. And I think that really does underpin, like, the, not surreality, but just the sort of fuzziness of the world.
Yeah, no, I think you're definitely on to something there. And I it's kind of funny because apparently the soundtrack was never released in North America. It only saw release in Germany, of all places.
Oh.
Which, yeah, no, seriously, somebody released the score, original score here. Yes, I know the title track is on, you know, America's Greatest Hits album, but seriously, get the rest of the music out there. This one is something I would probably listen to even without the film itself playing. So, yeah. Okay, so I guess for myself, I mean, I think I've been fairly upfront about how much I really, really enjoy this film. I would say that perhaps if I have to give another bit of a shout-out to anybody involved in this film are probably, I don't know, because I really have kind of sort of have exhausted a great deal of what I've meant to say about this one. I can think of a few pits that I haven't mentioned.
All right. Well, maybe when we switch over to pits, I'll realize I've said everything that I complain about in this film.
All right.
Yeah. So do you have a pit that we haven't mentioned?
Yes. The tree. Probably the low point of this movie, which is,
oh yeah. Until you said that now, I actually forgot that that happened.
It literally is the weird, I mean, both the weirdest and most adult section of this movie. Because for those who don't know what we're talking about, basically Schmendrick, after being sort of tied up by Cully's men, decides to sort of cast a spell to try to get himself out and transform what he's tied to into a giant sentient tree with breasts. Which he is sort of being smothered in as it declares his love for him.
One of those, one of those moments in the film that's shot for dad.
I guess it's like,
horrible.
It is weird, and I mean, I'll put it this way. I appreciate most of the weirdness of this movie and some of the more adult content. This is the exception to that rule.
Here it's trying to do adult content in the sense that it comes off as juvenile. You know, it's like a 12-year-old kid that learns their first swear word. It's not subversive or cheeky. It just comes off as crass and garish.
Like, it's probably the sequence that would be most in place in heavy metal, without question. But again,
you're not wrong there.
Yeah, and that's kind of what my problem with heavy metal is. It is, you know, adult in the most childish notion of what that means possible. So the bit with the tree is definitely, I think, the low point of this movie. What about you, Andrew? I'm sure you got at least one more pit in you somewhere.
Just on the whole, like, everybody on the voice cast, like, and again, I can see why you read this as a deliberate choice, but everybody just sounds so defeated and tired and sad. And, okay, like, I'm saying it's fine if that's the point of it, but then at the end, when everything's okay and, you know, people learn their lessons, like, there are moments that are supposed to be celebratory, and they're not. And it's not because, like, oh, everyone's too world weary. It's that the actors literally do not know how to emote the lines that they're saying. Like, Schmedrick and, what's her name, Rose?
Oh!
When they ride off at the end.
Yeah,
and he's like...
Yeah, Molly Greer. Yeah.
Molly, that's the one. And yeah, like, they bid farewell to the unicorn, and then it's just, whoa, I wonder where I'm going to go to now that I saved that unicorn. And then he's like, well, Molly, do you want to come with me? And she's like, I do. And then they, like, embrace each other. But it's like, it should be like, yeah, like, it's a good sentiment. They agree to go together. What if at the end of Casablanca, you know, Rick, who's as world-weary as they come, you know, he says, well, Louis, I guess this is the start of a beautiful friendship. Like, it wouldn't... Some lines need to be read a certain way. And that's one of those clear moments where I'm like, no, they clearly botched that one. I don't know. It's just like, I don't understand why it's so hard for, like, people only seem to get their voice performance right, like, midway through the film, as if they were recording in chronological real time. Because, like, especially that first part with Schmendrick's introduction, Alan Arkin is both mumbling and speaking very rapidly using fantasy lingo. And it is next to impossible to understand anything he's saying. And it's Alan Arkin. There should never be a time where you can't understand what he's saying.
Yeah. No, and that is definitely fair. And that kind of leads me to my pit as well, because we haven't really mentioned Molly, played by Tammy Grimes in the film. And that's basically because there's not much to her. Credit, though, where credit's due, Beagle has pretty much admitted as much. That was a character he severely underwrote and kind of regrets going there. So kudos to at least recognizing your failings. But yeah, Molly is pretty much there because I guess the party needed a third member. It's
good things come in threes.
Yeah, I mean... And again, I kind of like the idea of what they're building up. I mean, again, our team consists of a unicorn who may or may not be the last member of their species, a inept magician, a not terribly great cook slash homemaker who's just gotten through serving a bunch of woodland-based bandits who are more sad and pathetic than they are romantic, and a prince who basically is, you know, in charge of a decrepit kingdom that doesn't really exist anymore. There is something kind of nifty about that notion of this is the group that we've put together here, but she really has no objective in this movie other than to, oh, she's the person that everybody goes to speak to their problems about, which is kind of problematic given that she's the only... aside from the unicorn, the only other woman character in the film.
And the only maternal character.
Yeah, and that's kind of, yeah, a bit problematic. I'm also not entirely sure when she sees the unicorn for the first time, she has that big freak out about where were you 20 years ago? Where were you 10 years ago? I'm not positive what the difference would have been.
Yeah, because I thought at first that was Molly signaling that she was a unicorn that became human, and then I realized, no, by the end of this film, I'm like, I guess I was just thinking about Blade Runner a lot this week.
I assume that there was either a deleted scene or it was something from Beagle's novel that was probably trimmed down. I have to imagine there was...
Or the alternative is there was just nothing there.
It's possible. I'm going to give benefit of the doubt on this one. Mainly because I feel like it. But, you know, it definitely does not work, ultimately, in the case of this film. So, yeah, I honestly don't know what was going on with her. And she is kind of like she's a third wheel. She doesn't really have a place in this narrative other than to serve a plot point.
Well, somebody's got to sweep up after the talking cat, which I realize we haven't even mentioned. Yeah, I guess final thoughts on the last unicorn, Dave.
again, your enjoyment of this and the pleasure you take from it is going to be how down you are with its eccentricities and the the weirdness that comes out of not being an entirely successful film. I really kind of dig the not successful vibe that this movie puts off. I really enjoy the effort that's there behind its failings. I mean, there are films that are that fail where they're just flat out failures and you can't deny it. There are failures that are not, you can take no pleasure in watching. This one, I think there's a great deal of pleasure to be found, not ironically, but just in watching them struggle to pull something off. And even if they're not successful, it's interesting. And if nothing else, you got one hell of a soundtrack to listen to, minus a single number.
That's true. Yeah, if you want the New Yorker essay review of this, I would say, okay, got one. It's this film is one of its kind, much like the titular unicorn. However, one is the loneliest number.
That's a Three Dog Night song.
Well, yeah. Three dogs are less lonely than one unicorn.
Oh, my God. Okay.
So, hey, David.
Yeah.
I am going to take the steering wheel away from you.
Apparently.
Until you demonstrate that you can exercise better judgment in our destinations.
I regret nothing of what I've done.
Nor should you. That forest was beautiful. I'm sorry that that bull set it all on fire. But that sounds like a their problem. Our problem, coming up next episode, takes us all the way to Vienna in the form of our man Brother Theodore, who appears in Carol Reed's classic film, The Third Man.
This might be the single biggest pushing of our mandate that we've ever done for a justifying it, looking at another film. Thus far, I will say it's still early on in our run. But I'm going to allow it, and yeah, this will be a completely different film than what we just watched.
Well, exactly, and a film that takes us back into the past, a film that takes us to the heyday of, like, high noir, a film that takes us to Joseph Cotten, which is never a bad thing, and after all these films that we've kind of had to argue about and try and determine, especially your Machine Gun McCain's, for instance, where we honestly don't know what we think about it, I think there will be something very refreshing about you and I sitting down to talk about what is routinely regarded as one of the very best films of all time.
Absolutely. No argument for me on that one. But until then, folks, I guess maybe you have some questions. Maybe you have your own thoughts on The Last Unicorn. Maybe you want to tell Andrew that he's outright wrong, or point out to me that, David, what on earth were you doing picking this movie in the first place? You might wonder, how can you do that? Well, the good news, folks, is you can find me on Twitter at 24Panels, and you can find Andrew at Twitter at Filmstripper on there. Any other places they can find you, Andrew?
Nothing that I want to reveal to the public at this time, but yes, feel free to hop on Twitter. Dave and I are certainly a lot less aggressive than we appear. Yeah, if there's anything going on in the show that you'd like to talk more about, or anything that you'd like us to talk more about, you know, the best way is get in touch with us. Again, we're still figuring out what we're doing on a week-to-week basis, but the easiest way to make the kind of content you like is to let us know. As always, the best way to spread the film strip and get fellow passengers is to rate or review. 5 stars on iTunes is usually the best go-to. We seem to be building a listener base against all odds, and yeah, if it's all thanks to you folks who make it happen.
Yeah, so thank you very much for tuning in, and thank you for sticking with us so far. So we'll be back next time with our look at The Third Man. Any parting words, Andrew, before we go?
Yes. Life may be an adventure through an enchanted forest full of guys with Brooklyn accents. But remember, on that adventure... Oh, man, I cannot remember the first
part. Monotony will kill you. Or monotony... Monotony may scare, or not, goddamn.
Adventure might scare you, but monotony will kill you. And this, folks, is why you rehearse.
Goodbye, folks.
Till next time.